Where did you learn to do that? Play, missing a string, I mean.
I thought for a moment.
Do you want the short or the long of it?
I'll take the short for now.
I smiled.
Well, in that case, it's just something I picked up.
I made a casual gesture as if tossing something away.
A remnant of my misspent youth.
Stanchion gave me a long look, his expression amused.
I suppose I deserve that. I'll take the long version next time.
He took a deep breath and looked around the room. His golden earrings swung and caught the light.
I'm off to mix the crowd. I'll keep them from coming at you all at once.
I grinned relief.
Thank you, sir.
He shook his head and made a peremptory motion to someone behind the bar, who quickly fetched him his tankard.
Earlier tonight, sir, was proper and good, but now it's Stanchion.
He glanced back in my direction, and I smiled and nodded.
And I should call you...
Kvothe, I said.
Just Kvothe.
Just Kvothe,
Willem toasted behind me.
And Halloween,
Simon added and began to cry softly into the crook of his arm. Count Threep was one of the first to come to me. He looked shorter up close and older, but he was bright-eyed and laughing as he talked about my song.
It broke,
he said, gesturing wildly.
And all I could think was, not now, not before the ending. But I saw the blood on your hand, and my stomach knotted up. You looked up at us, then down at the strings, and it got quieter and quieter. Then you put your hands back on the lute, and all I could think was, there's a brave boy, too brave. He doesn't know he can't save the end of a broken song with a broken lute, but you did.
He laughed as if I'd played a joke on the world and danced a quick jig step. Simon, who had stopped crying and was on his way to becoming well-buttered, laughed along with the count. Willem didn't seem to know what to make of the man and watched him with serious eyes.
You must play at my house some day,
Threep said, then quickly held up a hand.
We won't talk of that now, and I won't take up any more of your evening.
He smiled.
But before I go, I need to ask you one last question. How many years did Savian spend with the Amir?
I didn't have to think about it.
6. 3 years proving himself, 3 years training.
Does 6 strike you as a good number?
I didn't know what he was getting at.
6 isn't exactly a lucky number, I hedged. If I were looking for a good number, I'd have to go up to 7, I shrugged, or down to 3.
Threep considered this, tapping his chin.
All right. 6 years with the Amir means he came back to Halloween on the 7th year.
He dug into a pocket and brought out a handful of coins of at least 3 different currencies. He sorted 7 talents out of the mess and pushed them into my surprised hand.
My lord,
I stammered, I cannot take your money. It wasn't the money itself that surprised me, but the amount. Threep looked confused.
Why ever not?
I gaped a little bit, and for a rare moment I was at a loss for words. Threep chuckled and closed my hand around the coins.
It's not a reward for playing. Well, it is that, but it's more an incentive for you to keep practicing, keep getting better. It's for the sake of the music.
He shrugged.
You see, a laurel needs rain to grow. I can't do much about that, but I can keep that rain off a few musicians' heads, can't I?
A sly smile wound its way onto his face.
So, God will tend the laurels and keep them wet, and I will tend the players and keep them dry, and wiser minds than mine will decide when to bring the two together.
I was silent for a moment.
I think you might be wiser than you give yourself credit for.
Well,
he said, trying not to look pleased.
Well, don't let it get around, or people will start expecting great things from me.
He turned and was quickly swallowed by the crowd. I slid the 7 talents into my pocket and felt a great weight lift from my shoulders. It was like a stay of execution, perhaps literally, as I had no idea how Devi might have encouraged me to pay my debt. I drew my first carefree breath in 2 months. It felt good. After Threep left, one of the talented musicians came to offer his compliments. After him, it was a Kaldish moneylender who shook my hand and offered to buy me a drink. Then there was a minor nobleman, another musician, and a pretty young lady that I thought might be my Alowine until I heard her voice. She was the daughter of a local moneylender, and we talked of small things briefly before she moved on. I remembered my manners almost too late and kissed her hand before she left. They all blurred together after a while. One by one they came to give me their regards, compliments, handshakes, advice, envy, and admiration. Though Stanchion was true to his word and managed to keep them all from coming at me in a mass, it wasn't long before I began having trouble telling one from another. The Metheglin wasn't helping matters either. I'm not sure how long it was before I thought to look for Ambrose. After scanning the room, I nudged Simon with an elbow until he looked up from the game he and Willem were playing with Shims.
"Where's our best friend?"
I asked. Simon gave me a blank look, and I realized that he was too far into his cups to catch sarcasm.
"Ambrose," I clarified. "Where's Ambrose?"
"Scofferdorf,"
Willem announced with an edge of bellicosity.
"As soon as you finished playing, before you'd even got your pipes."
He knew,
Simon sing-songed delightedly.
"He knew you would get them and couldn't bear to watch."
"Looked bad when he left,"
Willem said with a quiet malice.
"Pale and shaken, like he'd found out someone had been lanting in his drinks all night."
"Maybe someone was,"
Simon said with uncharacteristic viciousness.
"I would." "Shaking?"
I asked. Willem nodded.
"Trembling, like someone had gut-punched him. Linton was giving him an arm to lean on when he left."
The symptoms sounded familiar, like binder's chills. A suspicion began to form. I pictured Ambrose listening to me glide through the most beautiful song he'd ever heard, and realizing I'm about to win my pipes. He wouldn't do anything obvious, but perhaps he could find a loose thread or a long splinter from the table. Either one would provide only the most tenuous, sympathetic link to my lute string, 1% at best, perhaps only a tenth of that. I imagined Ambrose drawing on his own body's heat, concentrating as the chill slowly worked into his arms and legs. I pictured him trembling, his breath growing labored, until finally the string breaks, and I finish the song in spite of him. I grinned at the thought. Pure speculation, of course, but something had certainly broken my lute string, and I didn't doubt for a second that Ambrose would try something of the sort. I focused back in on Simon.
"It's up to him and say, 'No hard feelings about that time in the crucible when you mixed my salts and I was nearly blind for a day. No, no, really, drink up.'"
Simon laughed, lost in his own vengeful fantasy. The flood of well-wishers slowed somewhat. A fellow lutist, the talented piper I'd seen on stage, a local merchant. A heavily perfumed gentleman with long oiled hair and a Vintic accent clapped me on the back and gave me a purse of money.
"For new strings."
I didn't like him. I kept the purse.
"Why does everyone keep going on about that?"
Willem asked me.
"About what?" "Half the people that come over to shake your hand bubble over about how beautiful the song was. The other half hardly mention the song at all, and all they talk about is how you played with a broken string. It's like they didn't hardly hear the song at all."
"The first half don't know anything about music," Simon said. "Only people who take their music seriously can really appreciate what our little Elia here did tonight."
Willem grunted thoughtfully.
"It's hard, then, what you did."
"I've never seen anyone play Squirrel in the Thatch without a full set of strings,"
Simon told him.
"Well," he said, "you made it look easy. Since you have come to your sense in pushing aside that illish fruit drink, will you let me buy you a round of fine dark Scotton, drink of the kings of Kaldim?"
I know a compliment when I hear it, but I was reluctant to accept as I was just beginning to feel clear-headed again. Luckily, I was saved from having to make an excuse by Maria coming to pay her respects. She was the lovely golden-haired harper who had tried for her talent and failed. I thought for a moment that she might be the voice of my Halloween, but after a moment's listening to her, I realized it couldn't be. She was pretty, though, even prettier than she had seemed on stage, as is not always the case. Talking, I found she was the daughter of one of Imre's councilmen. Against the tumble of her deep golden hair, the soft blue of her gown was a reflection of the deep blue of her eyes. Lovely as she was, I couldn't give her the concentration she deserved. I itched to be away from the bar to find the voice that had sung Halloween with me. We talked a while, smiled, and parted with kind words and promises to speak again. She disappeared back into the crowd, a wonderful collection of gently moving curves.
"What was that shameful display?"
Willem demanded after she had gone.
"What?"
I asked.
"What?"
he mocked my tone.
"Can you even pretend to be that thick? If a girl as fair as that looked at me with one eye the way she looked at you with two, we'd have a room by now, to say it carefully."
"She was friendly," I protested, "and we were talking. She asked me if I would show her some harp fingerings, but it's been a long time since I played harp."
"It'll be a lot longer if you keep missing passes like that,"
Willem said frankly.
"She was doing everything but taking down another button for you."
Sim leaned over and lay his hand on my shoulder, the very picture of the concerned friend.
"Cuth, I've been meaning to talk to you about this very problem. If you honestly couldn't tell that she was interested in you, you might want to admit the possibility that you are impossibly thick when it comes to women. You may want to consider the priesthood."
"The both of you are drunk,"
I said to cover my flush.
"Did you happen to notice from our conversation that she is a councilman's daughter?"
"Did you notice,"
Will replied in the same tone,
"how she looked at you?"
I knew I was woefully inexperienced with women, but I didn't have to admit to it. So I waved his comment away and got down off my stool.
"Somehow I doubt that a quick romp behind the bar was what she had in mind."
I took a drink of water and straightened my cloak.
"Now,
I must go find my Halloween and offer her my earnest thanks. How do I look?"
"What is it, Ma?"
Willem asked. Simon touched Willem's elbow.
"Don't you see? He's after more dangerous game than some low-bodied councilman's daughter."
I turned from them with a disgusted gesture and headed off into the crowded room. I didn't really have any idea how I would find her. Some foolish, romantic part of me thought I would know her when I saw her. If she were half as radiant as her voice, she would shine like a candle in a dark room. But as I thought these things, the wiser part of me was whispering in my other ear, "Do not hope," it said. "Do not dare hold hope that any woman could burn as brightly as the voice that sang the part of Halloween." And while this voice was not comforting, I knew it to be wise. I had learned to listen to it on the streets of Tarbin, where it had kept me alive. I wandered through the first level of the Aeolian, searching without knowing who I was looking for. Occasionally, people would smile or wave. After 5 minutes, I had seen all the faces there were to see and moved to the second level. This was actually a converted balcony, but instead of tiers of seats, there were rising ranks of tables that looked onto the lower level. As I wended my way through the tables looking for my Halloween, my wiser half kept murmuring in my ear, "Do not hope. All you will earn is disappointment. She will not be as beautiful as you imagine, and then you will despair." As I finished searching the second level, a new fear began to rise in me. She might have left while I was sitting at the bar, drinking in metheglin and praise. I should have gone to her straight away, fallen to one knee, and thanked her with my whole heart. What if she was gone? What if no one knew who she was or where she had gone? A nervousness settled into the pit of my stomach as I took the stairs to the highest level of the Aeolian.
"Now look what your hope has brought you," the voice said. "She is gone, and all you have is a bright, foolish imagining to torment yourself with."
The last level, was the smallest of the three, hardly more than a thin crescent that hugged three walls high above the stage. Here the tables and benches were more widely spaced and sparsely populated. I noticed that the inhabitants of this level were mostly couples, and I felt something of a voyeur as I passed from table to table. Trying to appear casual, I looked at the faces of those who sat talking and drinking. I grew more nervous the closer I came to the last table. It was impossible for me to do so casually, as it was in a corner. The couple sitting there, one light-haired and one dark, had their backs to me. As I approached, the light-haired one laughed, and I caught a glimpse of a proud, fine-featured face. A man. I turned my attention to the woman with the long dark hair. My last hope. I knew she would be my Alowin. Coming round the corner of the table, I saw her face. Or rather, his face. They were both men. My Alowin had left. I had lost her. And with that knowledge, I felt as if my heart had been tipped from its resting place in my chest to topple and fall somewhere deep inside me near my feet. They looked up, and the fair-haired one smiled at me.
Look here, young Six-String has come to offer us his respects.
He eyed me up and down.
You're a fair one. Would you like to join us for a drink?
No, I murmured, embarrassed. I was just looking for someone.
Well, you found someone,
he said easily, touching my arm.
My name is Fallon, and this is Tria. Come and have a drink.
I promise to keep Tria here from trying to take you home. He has a terrible weakness for musicians. He smiled charmingly at me. I murmured an excuse and took my leave, too distraught to worry whether or not I had made an ass of myself. As I made my desolate way back to the stairs, my wise self took the opportunity to berate me.
That is what comes of hope, it said. No good. Still, you're better having missed her. She could never have been equal to her voice.
That voice, fair and terrible as burning silver, like moonlight on river stones, like a feather against your lips.
I headed to the stairs, eyes on the floor, lest anyone try to catch me in a conversation. Then, I heard a voice. A voice like burning silver, like a kiss against my ears. Looking up, my heart lifted, and I knew it was my Alowin. Looking up, I saw her, and all I could think was beautiful. Beautiful.
Chapter 57 Interlude. The Parts That Form Us. Moving slowly, Bast stretched and looked around the room. Finally, the short fuse of his patience burned out.
Reshi?
Hmm? Kvothe looked at him.
And then what, Reshi? Did you talk to her?
Of course I talked to her. There would be no story if I hadn't. Telling that part is easy, but first I must describe her. I'm not sure how to do it.
Bast fidgeted. Kvothe laughed, a fond expression wiping the irritation from his face.
So is describing a beautiful woman as easy as looking at one for you?
Bast looked down and blushed, and Kvothe laid a gentle hand on his arm, smiling.
My trouble, Bast, is that she is very important. Important to the story. I cannot think of how to describe her without falling short of the mark.
I think I understand, Reshi, Bast said in conciliatory tones. I've seen her too, once.
Kvothe sat back in his chair, surprised.
You have, haven't you? I'd forgotten.
He pressed his hands to his lips.
How would you describe her, then?
Bast brightened at the opportunity. Straightening up in his chair, he looked thoughtful for a moment, then said,
She had perfect ears.
He made a delicate gesture with his hands.
Perfect little ears, like they were carved out of something.
Chronicler laughed, then looked slightly taken aback, as if he'd surprised himself.
Her ears,
he asked as if he couldn't be sure he had heard correctly. You know how hard it is to find a pretty girl with the right sort of ears, Bast said matter-of-factly. Chronicler laughed again, seeming to find it easier the second time.
No, he said. No, I'm sure I don't.
Bast gave the story collector a deeply pitying look.
Well then, you'll just have to take my word for it. They were exceptionally fine.
I think you struck that chord well enough, Bast, Quoth said amused. He paused for a moment, and when he spoke again it was slowly, his eyes far away. The trouble is, she is unlike anyone I have ever known. There was something intangible about her, something compelling, like heat from a fire. She had a grace, a spark.
She had a crooked nose, Reshi,
Bast said, interrupting his master's reverie. Kvothe looked at him, a line of irritation creasing his forehead.
What?
Bast held his hands up defensively.
It's just something I noticed, Reshi. All the women in your story are beautiful. I can't gainsay you as a whole, as I've never seen any of them, but this one I did see. Her nose was a little crooked, and if we're being honest here, her face was a little narrow for my taste. She wasn't a perfect beauty by any means, Reshi. I should know. I've made some study of these things.
Kvothe stared at his student for a long moment, his expression solemn.
We are more than the parts that form us, Bast, he said with a hint of reproach.
I'm not saying she wasn't lovely, Reshi, Bast said quickly. She smiled at me. It went right down into you, if you understand me.
I understand, Bast, but then again, I've met her, Quoth looked at Chronicler. The trouble comes from comparison, you see. If I say she was dark-haired, you might think, I've known dark-haired women, some of them lovely, but you would be far off the mark, because that woman would not really have anything in common with her. That other woman wouldn't have her quick wit, her easy charm. She was unlike anyone I have ever met.
Quoth trailed off, looking down at folded hands. He was quiet for such a long moment that Bast began to fidget, looking around anxiously.
There's no sense worrying, I suppose, Quoth said at last,
looking up and motioning to Chronicler.
If I ruin this as well, it will be a small thing as far as the world is concerned.
Chronicler picked up his pen, and Quoth began to speak before he had the chance to dip it.
Her eyes were dark. Dark as chocolate, dark as coffee, dark as the polished wood of my father's lute. They were set in a fair face, oval, like a teardrop.
Kvothe stopped suddenly as if he had run himself out of words. The silence was so sudden and deep that Chronicler glanced briefly up from his page, something he had not done before. But even as Chronicler looked up, another flood of words burst out of Kvothe.
Her easy smile could stop a man's heart. Her lips were red, not the garish painted red so many women believe makes them desirable. Her lips were always red, morning and night, as if minutes before you saw her, she had been eating sweet berries or drinking heart's blood. No matter where she stood, she was in the center of the room.
Quoth frowned.
Do not misunderstand. She was not loud or vain. We stare at a fire because it flickers, because it glows. The light is what catches our eyes, but what makes a man lean close to a fire has nothing to do with its bright shape. What draws you to a fire is the warmth you feel when you come near. The same was true of Denna.
As Quoth spoke, his expression twisted as if each word he spoke rankled him more and more. And while the words were clear, they matched his expression, as if each one was rasped with a rough file before it left his mouth.
She...
Quoth's head was bowed so low, he seemed to be speaking to his hands laying in his lap.
What am I doing?
He said faintly, as if his mouth was full of grey ash.
What good can come of this? How can I make any sense of her for you when I have never understood the last piece of her myself?
Chronicler had written most of this out before he realized that Quoth had probably not intended him to. He froze for a bare moment, then finished scratching down the rest of the sentence. Then he waited a long, quiet moment before he stole a look upward at Quoth. Quoth's eyes caught and held him. They were the same dark eyes that Chronicler had seen before. Eyes like angry gods. For a moment it was all Chronicler could do to not draw back from the table. There was an icy silence. Quoth stood and pointed at the paper that lay in front of Chronicler.
"Cross that out," he grated.
Chronicler blanched, his expression as stricken as if he'd been stabbed. When he made no move, Quoth reached down and calmly slid the half-written sheet from under Chronicler's pen.
"If crossing out is something you feel disinclined towards."
Quoth tore the half-written sheet with slow care, the sound bleeding the color from Chronicler's face. With terrible deliberateness, Quoth lifted a blank sheet and lay it carefully in front of the stunned scribe. One long finger stabbed at the torn sheet, smearing the still wet ink.
"Copy to here,"
he said in a voice that was cold and motionless as iron. The iron was in his eyes too, hard and dark. There was no arguing. Chronicler quietly copied to where Quoth's finger pinned the paper to the table. Once Chronicler was finished, Quoth began to speak crisply and clearly, as if he were biting off pieces of ice.
"In what manner was she beautiful? I realize that I cannot say enough. So, since I cannot say enough, at least I will avoid saying too much. Say this, that she was dark-haired. There. It was long and straight. She was dark of eye and fair-complected. There. Her face was oval, her jaw strong and delicate. Say that she was poised and graceful. There."
Quoth took a breath before continuing.
"Finally, say that she was beautiful. That is all that can be well said. That she was beautiful, through to her bones, despite any flaw or fault. She was beautiful. To Quoth, at least.
At least?
To Quoth, she was most beautiful."
For a moment, Quoth tensed, as if he would leap up and tear this sheet away from Chronicler as well. Then he relaxed, like a sail when the wind leaves it.
"But to be honest, it must be said that she was beautiful to others as well."
Chapter 58. Names for Beginning. It would be nice to say that our eyes met and I moved smoothly to her side. It would be nice to say that I smiled and spoke of pleasant things in carefully metered rhyming couplets like Prince Gallant from some fairy story. Unfortunately, life is seldom so carefully scripted. In truth, I simply stood. It was Denna, the young woman I had met in Rowan's caravan so long ago. Come to think of it, it had only been half a year. Not so long when you're listening to a story, but half a year is a great long while to live through, especially if you're young, and we were both of us very young. I caught sight of Denna as she was climbing the final step onto the third level of the Aeolian. Her eyes were downcast, her expression thoughtful, almost sad. She turned and began to walk in my direction without lifting her eyes from the floor, without seeing me. The months had changed her. Where before she had been pretty, now she was lovely as well. Perhaps that difference was only that she wasn't wearing the road clothes I had met her in, but a long dress instead. But it was Denna without a doubt. I even recognized the ring on her finger, silver set with a pale blue stone. Since we parted ways, I had kept foolish, fond thoughts of Denna hidden in a secret corner of my heart. I had thought of making the trip to Annelin and tracking her down, of meeting her by chance on the road again, of her coming to find me at the university. But deep down I knew these thoughts for nothing more than childish daydreams. I knew the truth. I would never see her again. But here she was, and I was entirely unprepared. Would she even remember me, the awkward boy she had known for a few days so long ago? Denna was barely a dozen feet away when she looked up and saw me. Her expression brightened as if someone had lit a candle inside her and she was glowing from its light. She rushed towards me, closing the distance between us in three excited skipping steps. For a moment she looked as if she would run straight into my arms, but at the last moment she pulled back, darting a glance at the people sitting around us. In the space of half a step, she transformed her delighted headlong run into a demure greeting at arm's length. It was gracefully done, but even so, she had to reach out a hand and steady herself against my chest, lest she stumble into me due to her sudden stop. She smiled at me then. It was warm and sweet and shy, like a flower unfurling. It was friendly and honest, and slightly embarrassed. When she smiled at me, I felt, I honestly cannot think of how I could describe it. Lying would be easier. I could steal from 100 stories and tell you a lie so familiar you would swallow it whole. I could say my knees went to rubber, that my breath came hard in my chest. But that would not be the truth. My heart did not pound or stop or stutter. That is the sort of thing they say happens in stories. Foolishness, hyperbole, tripe. But still. Go out in the early days of winter, after the first cold snap of the season. Find a pool of water with a sheet of ice across the top, still fresh and new and clear as glass. Near the shore, the ice will hold you. Slide out farther. Farther. Eventually you'll find the place where the surface just barely bears your weight. There you will feel what I felt. The ice splinters under your feet. Look down and you can see the white cracks darting through the ice like mad, elaborate spiderwebs. It is perfectly silent, but you can feel the sudden sharp vibrations through the bottoms of your feet. That is what happened when Denna smiled at me. I don't mean to imply I felt as if I stood on brittle ice about to give way beneath me. No, I felt like the ice itself suddenly shattered with cracks spiraling out from where she had touched my chest. The only reason I held together was because my 1,000 pieces were all leaning together. If I moved, I feared I would fall apart. Perhaps it is enough to say that I was caught by a smile. I know that sounds as if it came from a storybook. It is very near the truth. Words have never been difficult for me, quite the opposite, in fact. Often I find it all too easy to speak my mind, and things go badly because of it. However, here, in front of Denna, I was too stunned to speak. I could not have said a sensible word to save my life. Without thinking, all the courtly manners my mother had drilled into me came to the fore. I reached out smoothly and clasped Denna's outstretched hand in my own as if she'd offered it to me. Then I took a half step backward and made a genteel three-quarter bow. At the same time, my free hand caught hold of the edge of my cloak and tucked it behind my back. It was a flattering bow, courtly without being ridiculously formal, and safe for a public setting such as this. What next? A kiss on the hand was traditional, but what sort of kiss was appropriate? In Atur, you merely nod over the hand. Kildish ladies like the moneylender's daughter I had chatted with earlier expect you to brush the knuckles lightly and make a kissing sound. In Mordegh, you actually press your lips to the back of your own thumb. But we were in Commonwealth, and Denna showed no foreign accent. A straightforward kiss, then. I pressed my lips gently to the back of her hand for the space of time it takes to draw a quick breath. Her skin was warm and smelled vaguely of heather.
"I am at your service, my lady," I said, standing and releasing her hand.
For the first time in my life, I understood the true purpose of this sort of formal greeting. It gives you a script to follow when you have absolutely no idea what to say.
"My lady?"
Denner echoed, sounding a little surprised.
"Very well, if you insist."
She took hold of her dress with one hand and bobbed a curtsy, somehow managing to make it look graceful and mocking and playful all at once.
"Your lady."
Hearing her voice, I knew my suspicions were true. She was my Alowine.
"What are you doing up here in the third circle alone?"
She glanced around the crescent-shaped balcony.
"Are you alone?"
"I was alone," I said. Then, when I could think of nothing else to say, I borrowed a line from the song fresh in my memory.
"Now, unexpected, Alowine beside me stands."
She smiled at that, flattered.
"How do you mean unexpected?"
she asked.
"I had more than half convinced myself that you'd already left." "It was a near thing,"
Denner said archly.
2 hours I waited for my Savian to come.
She sighed tragically, glancing up and to one side like a statue of a saint.
"Finally, filled with despair, I decided Alowine could do the finding this time, and damn the story."
She smiled a wicked smile. "So we were ill-lit ships at night," I quoted.
"Passing close, but all unknown to one another,"
Denner finished.
"Felward's falling,"
I said with something that touched the outward boundary of respect.
"Not many people know that play." "I am not many people," she said.
"I will never forget that again." I bowed my head with exaggerated deference. She snorted derisively. I ignored it and continued in a more serious tone.
"I can't thank you enough for helping me tonight."
"You can't," she said.
"Well, that's a shame. How much can you thank me?"
Without thinking, I reached up to the collar of my cloak and unpinned my talent pipes.
"Only this much," I said, holding them out to her.
Denner hesitated, somewhat taken aback.
"You can't be serious."
"Without you, I wouldn't have won them," I said. "And I have nothing else of any value. Unless you want my loot." Denner's dark eyes studied my face, as if she couldn't decide if I was making fun or not.
"I don't think you can give away your pipes."
"I can, actually," I said. "Stanchion mentioned if I lost them or gave them away, I'd have to earn another set." I took her hand, uncurled her fingers, then laid the silver pipes on her palm. "That means I can do with them as I please, and it pleases me to give them to you." Denner stared at the pipes in her hand, then looked at me with deliberate attention as if she hadn't entirely noticed me before. For a moment I was painfully aware of my appearance. My cloak was threadbare, and even wearing my best clothes I was a short step from shabby. She looked down again and slowly closed her hand around the pipes. Then she looked up at me, her expression unreadable.
"I think you might be a wonderful person," she said.
I drew a breath, but Denner spoke first.
"However," she said, "this is too great a thanks. More payment than is appropriate for any help I've given you, I would end up in your debt."
She caught hold of my hand and pressed the pipes back into it.
"I would rather have you beholden to me,"
she grinned suddenly.
"This way, you still owe me a favor."
The room grew noticeably quieter. I looked around, confused due to the fact that I'd forgotten where I was. Denner lay a finger to her lips and pointed over the railing to the stage below. We stepped closer to the edge and looked down to see an old man with a white beard opening an oddly shaped instrument case. I sucked in a surprised breath when I saw what he was holding.
"What is that thing?"
Denner asked.
"It's an old court lute,"
I said, unable to keep the amazement out of my voice.
"I've never actually seen one before." "That's a lute."
Denner's lips moved silently.
"I count 24 strings. How does that even work? That's more than some harps."
That's how they made them years ago, before metal strings, before they knew how to brace a long neck. It's incredible. There's more careful engineering in that swan neck than in any three cathedrals.
I watched as the old man tucked his beard out of the way and adjusted himself in his seat.
I just hope he tuned it before he went on stage, I added softly. Otherwise, we'll be waiting an hour while he fiddles with his pegs. My father used to say the old minstrels used to spend 2 days stringing and 2 hours of tuning to get 2 minutes music from an old court lute.
It only took the old man about 5 minutes to get the strings in agreement. Then he began to play. I am shamed to admit it, but I remember nothing of the song. Despite the fact that I had never seen a court lute, let alone heard one, my mind was too awhirl with thoughts of Denner to absorb much else. As we leaned on the railing side by side, I snuck glances at her out of the corner of my eye. She hadn't called me by name or mentioned our meeting before in Rowan's caravan. That meant she didn't remember me. Not too surprising, I suppose, that she would forget a ragged boy she'd only known for a few days on the road. Still, it stung a bit, as I'd had fond thoughts of her for months. Still, there was no way to bring it up now without seeming foolish. Better to make a fresh start and hope I was more memorable the second time around. The song was over before I realized it, and I clapped enthusiastically to make up for my inattention.
I thought you'd made a mistake when you doubled your chorus earlier, Denner said to me as the applause died down. I couldn't believe you really wanted a stranger to join in. I haven't seen that done anywhere except around campfires at night.
I shrugged.
Everyone kept telling me this is where the best musicians played. I made a sweeping gesture with one hand toward her. I trusted someone would know the part.
She arched an eyebrow.
It was a near thing, she said. I waited for someone else to jump in instead. I was a little anxious to step in myself.
I gave her a puzzled look.
Why? You have a lovely voice.
She gave a sheepish grimace.
I'd only heard the song twice before this. I wasn't sure if I'd remember all of it.
Twice? Denner nodded.
And the second time was just a span ago. A couple played it during a formal dinner I attended off in Etnia.
Are you serious? I said incredulously. She tilted her head back and forth, as if caught in a white lie. Her dark hair fell across her face, and she brushed it away absent-mindedly.
Okay, I suppose I did hear the couple rehearse a little right before the dinner.
I shook my head, hardly believing it.
That's amazing. It's a terribly difficult harmony. And to remember all the lyrics.
I marveled silently for a moment, shaking my head.
You have an incredible ear.
You're not the first man to say that, Denner said wryly. But you might be the first to say it while actually looking at my ears.
She glanced down meaningfully. I felt myself beginning to blush furiously when I heard a familiar voice behind us.
There you are.
Turning, I saw Sauvoy, my tall, handsome friend and co-conspirator from Advanced Sympathy.
Here I am,
I said, surprised that he would seek me out. Doubly surprised that he would have the bad grace to interrupt me when I was in a private conversation with a young woman.
Here we all are,
Sauvoy smiled at me as he walked over and put his arm casually around Denner's waist. He made a mock frown at her.
I scour the bottom levels trying to help you find your singer, while all the while both of you are up here, thick as thieves.
We stumbled into each other,
Denner said, laying her hand over his where it rested on her hip.
I knew you'd come back for your drink, if nothing else.
She nodded to a nearby table, empty except for a pair of wine glasses. Together they turned and walked arm in arm back to their table. Denner looked over her shoulder at me and gave a sort of shrug with her eyebrows. I hadn't the slightest idea what the expression meant. Sauvoy waved me over to join them and pulled over an unoccupied chair so I would have a place to sit.
I couldn't quite believe it was you down there, he said to me. I thought I recognized your voice, but...
He gestured, indicating the highest level of the Aeolian.
While the third circle provides a comfortable privacy for young lovers, its view of the stage leaves little to be desired. I didn't know you played.
He settled a long arm across Denner's shoulders and smiled his charming blue-eyed smile. Off and on, I said flippantly as I sat down.
Lucky for you, I picked the Aeolian for our entertainment tonight,
Sauvoy said.
Otherwise, you'd have had nothing but echoes and crickets to accompany you. Then I'm in your debt, I said to him with a deferential nod. Make it up to me by taking Sim on as a partner next time we play corners, he said. That way you're the one to eat the forfeit when the giddy little bastards call the tall card with nothing but a pair.
Done, I said. Though it pains me, I turned to Denner.
What of you? I owe you a great favour. How can I repay it?
Ask anything, and it is yours, should it be within my skill.
Anything within your skill?
She repeated playfully.
What can you do, then, besides play so well that Taelu and his angels would weep to hear?
I imagine I could do anything, I said easily, if you would ask it of me. She laughed.
That's a dangerous thing to say to a woman, Sovoy said, especially this one. She'll have you off to bring her a leaf of the singing tree from the other side of the world.
She leaned back in her chair and looked at me with dangerous eyes.
A leaf of the singing tree, she mused. That might be a nice thing to have. Would you bring me one?
I would, I said, and was surprised to find that it was the truth. She seemed to consider it, then shook her head playfully.
I couldn't send you journeying so far away. I'll have to save my favour for another day.
I sighed.
So I am left in your debt. Oh no, she exclaimed. Another weight upon my Savian's heart. The reason my heart is so heavy is that I fear I might never know your name. I could keep thinking of you as Felurian, I said, but that could lead to unfortunate confusion.
She gave me an appraising look.
Felurian? I might like that if I didn't think you were a liar.
A liar? I said indignantly. My first thought in seeing you was, Felurian, what have I done? The adulation of my peers below has been a waste of hours. Could I recall the moments I have careless cast away? I could but hope to spend them in a wiser way and warm myself in light that rivals light of day.
She smiled.
A thief and a liar. You stole that from the third act of Deonica.
She knew Deonica too? Guilty, I admitted freely, but that doesn't make it untrue.
She smiled at Sovoy, then turned back to me.
Flattery is fine and good, but it won't win you my name. Sovoy mentioned you were keeping pace with him in the university. That means you meddle with dark forces, better left alone. If I give you my name, you would have a terrible power over me.
Her mouth was serious, but her smile showed itself around the corners of her eyes, in the tilt of her head.
That is very true,
I said with equal seriousness.
But I will make you a bargain. I'll give you my name in exchange. Then I will be in your power as well. You'd sell me my own shirt, she said. Sovoy knows your name. Assuming he hasn't told me already, I could have it from him as easy as breathing.
True enough, Sovoy said, seeming relieved that we remembered he was there.
He took up her hand and kissed the back of it.
He can tell you my name, I said dismissively,
but he cannot give it to you. Only I can do that.
I lay one hand flat on the table.
My offer stands, my name for yours. Will you take it, or will I be forced to think of you always as an Alowin, and never as yourself?
Her eyes danced.
Very well, she said. I'll have yours first, though.
I leaned forward and motioned for her to do the same. She let go of Sovoy's hand and turned an ear toward me. With due solemnity, I whispered my name in her ear.
Kvothe.
She smelled faintly of flowers, which I guessed was a perfume, but beneath that was her own smell. Like green grass, like the open road after a light spring rain. Then she leaned back into her seat and seemed to think of it for a while.
Kvothe,
she said eventually.
It suits you. Kvothe.
Her eyes sparkled as if she held some hidden secret. She said it slowly as if tasting it, then nodded to herself.
What does it mean?
It means many things,
I said in my best tarball in the great voice.
but you will not distract me so easily. I have paid, and now am in your power. Would you give me your name, that I might call you by it?"
She smiled and leaned forward again. I did likewise. Turning my head to the side, I felt an errant strand of her hair brush against me.
"Diane."
Her warm breath was like a feather against my ear.
"Diane."
We both sat back in our seats. When I didn't say anything, she prompted me.
"Well?"
"I have it," I assured her. "As sure as I know my own."
"Say it then."
"I'm saving it," I reassured her, smiling. "Gifts like these should not be squandered." She looked at me. I relented. "Diane," I said.
"Diane, it suits you as well."
We looked at each other for a long moment. Then I noticed that Sovoy was giving me a not quite subtle stare. "I should get back downstairs," I said, rising quickly from my seat. "I've got important people to meet." I cringed inwardly at the awkwardness of the words as soon as I'd said them, but couldn't think of a less awkward way to take them back. Sovoy stood and shook my hand, no doubt eager to be rid of me.
"Well done tonight, Quoth. I'll be seeing you."
I turned to see Denna standing too. She met my eyes and smiled.
"I hope to see you too."
She held out her hand. I gave her my best smile. "There's always hope." I meant it to seem witty, but the words seemed to turn boorish as soon as they left my mouth. I had to leave before I made an even greater ass of myself. I shook her hand quickly. It was slightly cool to the touch, soft, delicate, and strong. I did not kiss it, as Sovoy was my friend, and that is not the sort of thing friends do. Chapter 59. All This Knowing. In the fullness of time, and with considerable help from Diok and Willem, I became drunk. Thus it was that three students made their slightly erratic way back to the university. See them as they go, weaving only slightly. It is quiet, and when the belling tower strikes the late hour, it doesn't break the silence so much as it underpins it. The crickets, too, respect the silence. Their calls are like careful stitches in its fabric, almost too small to be seen. The night is like warm velvet around them. The stars, burning diamonds in the cloudless sky, turn the road beneath their feet a silver grey. The university and Imre are the hearts of understanding and art, the strongest of the four corners of civilization. Here, on the road between the two, there is nothing but old trees and long grass bending to the wind. The night is perfect, in a wild way, almost terrifyingly beautiful. The three boys, one dark, one light, and one, for lack of a better word, fiery, do not notice the night. Perhaps some part of them does, but they are young and drunk and busy, knowing deep in their hearts that they will never grow old or die. They also know that they are friends, and they share a certain love that will never leave them. The boys know many other things, but none of them seem as important as this. Perhaps they are right. Chapter 60. Fortune. The next day, I went to the admissions lottery sporting my very first hangover. Weary and vaguely nauseous, I joined the shortest line and tried to ignore the din of hundreds of students milling about, buying, selling, trading, and generally complaining about the slots they'd drawn for their exams. "Quoth, Arlid and son," I said when I finally arrived at the front of the line. The bored-looking woman marked my name, and I drew a tile out of the black velvet bag. It read, "Hepton, noon. 5 days from now. Plenty of time to prepare." But as I turned back to the muse, a thought occurred to me. How much preparation did I really need? More importantly, how much could I genuinely accomplish without access to the archives? Thinking it over, I raised my hand over my head with my middle finger and thumb extended, signaling that I had a slot 5 days from now that I was willing to sell. It wasn't long before an unfamiliar student wandered close. "Fourth day," she said, holding up her own tile. "I'll give you a jot to trade." I shook my head. She shrugged and wandered away. Galvin, a Raylar from the Medica, approached me. He held up his index finger, indicating he had a slot later this afternoon. From the circles under his eyes and his anxious expression, I didn't think he was eager to go through testing that soon.
"Will you take 5 jots?
I'd like to get a whole talent." He nodded, flipping his own tile over between his fingers. It was a fair price. No one wanted to go through admissions on the first day.
"Maybe later. I'll look around a little first."
As I watched him leave, I marveled at the difference a single day could make. Yesterday, 5 jots would have seemed like all the money in the world, but today my purse was heavy. I was lost in vague musings about how much money I had actually earned last night when I saw Willem and Simon approaching. Will looked a little pale under his dark, kaledish complexion. I guessed he was feeling the after effects of our night's carousing, too. Sim, on the other hand, was bright and sunny as ever.
"Guess you drew slots this afternoon,"
he nodded over my shoulder.
"Ambrose and several of his friends, it's enough to make me believe in a just universe."
Turning to search the crowd, I heard Ambrose's voice before I saw him.
"From the same bag, that means they did a piss-poor job mixing. They should restart this whole mismanaged sham and..."
Ambrose was walking with several well-dressed friends, their eyes sweeping over the crowd looking for raised hands. Ambrose was a dozen feet away before he finally looked down and realized the hand he was heading towards was mine. He stopped short, scowling, then gave a sudden barking laugh.
"Ha! Ha! You poor boy! All the time in the world and no way to spend it. Hasn't Lauren let you back in yet?"
"Hammer and horn,"
Will said wearily behind me. Ambrose smiled at me.
"Tell you what, I'll give you halfpenny and one of my old shirts for your slot. That way you'll have something to wear when you're washing that one in the river."
A few of his friends chuckled behind him, looking me up and down. I kept my expression nonchalant, not wanting to give him any satisfaction. Truth was, I was all too aware of the fact that I only owned 2 shirts, and after 2 terms of constant wear, they were getting shabby. Shabbier. What's more, I did wash them in the river, as I'd never had money to spare for laundry.
"I'll pass," I said lightly. "Your shirt tails are a little richly dyed for my taste."
I tugged at the front of my own shirt to make my point clear. A few nearby students laughed.
"I don't get it,"
I heard Sim say quietly to Will.
"He's implying Ambrose has the..."
Will paused.
"The edematitas, a disease you get from whores. There is a discharge."
"Okay, okay,"
Sim said quickly.
"I get it. Ick. Ambrose is wearing green too."
Meanwhile, Ambrose forced himself to chuckle along with the crowd at my joke.
"I suppose I deserve that," he said. "Very well, pennies for the poor."
He brought out his purse and shook it.
"How much do you want?"
5 talents,
I said. He stared at me, frozen in the act of opening his purse. It was an outrageous price. A few of the spectators nudged each other with their elbows, obviously hoping I'd somehow swindle Ambrose into paying several times what my slot was actually worth.
"I'm sorry," I asked, "do you need that converted?"
It was a well-known fact that Ambrose had botched the arithmetic portion of his admissions last term.
5 is ridiculous," he said. "You'd be lucky to get 1 this late in the day."
I forced a careless shrug.
"I'd settle for 4.
"You'll settle for 1,
Ambrose insisted.
"I'm not an idiot."
I took a deep breath, let it out again, resigned.
"I don't suppose I could get you to go as high as 1 and 4?
I asked, disgusted by how plaintive my voice sounded. Ambrose smiled like a shark.
I tell you what, he said magnanimously. I'll give you 1 and 3.